What is going on, everyone? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. This is episode 39, and I am talking to Ruth Ann. This interview is gold, people. You are going to love this interview so much. So Ruth Ann ended up teaching in public schools and low-income schools for about 4 years, and through a series of events, ended up not teaching anymore, and now coaches teachers in their first and second year at low-income schools. And so I just can't think of a more important task than building up our teachers, especially in low-income schools where resources may not be as readily available. And I think burnout is high, that you would have somebody who steps in and can help people get through and thrive in that environment. And so what you hear from Ruth Ann in this interview is just really good stuff. It's really practical. It's educational. She does a really great job. She also is an avid book fan. And so you get a lot of really good book recommendations in this episode. All of these book recommendations, I'm going to ask that if you buy any of these books through this podcast, that you would shop the link in my bio, which goes to Annie Jones Bookstore in Thomasville, Georgia. I just feel like we should be supporting small businesses. I think that's an important value that we should all hold. So I'm just going to ask that if you end up doing that, if you'd go through that link and buy from her, there's no commission or whatever. There's no kickbacks or anything. I think it's important to use our money well, and I can't think of a more noble place to spend it than with Annie Jones. So you can check her interview out. Anyway, while you're thinking about it, would you go ahead and leave me a review? I have to say, I just got a review this week from somebody named Sarah out in Colorado, and it's the first like legit review from somebody that I don't know personally, and it just like meant the world to me. I posted about it on Instagram, but it was just so cool to see that the podcast is reaching people and that people actually enjoy it and are built up by it. That's beautiful to me. So the reviews aren't just for like advertising purposes or to get the podcast out there, but they really do mean a lot. And I read those things, and I definitely appreciate all those who have reviewed me so far. So appreciate you doing all of that. I do have a newsletter coming out monthly now, which will keep you updated on the new happenings coming up on the podcast. And it also involves a nerd corner, of which I just insert whatever nerdery I'm into at the time. So this last one that just went out has some new music recommendations for you. So you got to make sure and check that out. You can find that at my website, curryblanford.com. So if you want to stay up to date on the podcast, that is a great place to do that. There are so many good things coming up in this interview. I hope you enjoy hearing from Ruth Ann. Well, Ruth Ann, it is so nice to meet you. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so let's just jump off with you sort of introducing yourself to everybody.
Yeah, so anytime somebody asks me to introduce myself, I always tell them that I am the oldest of five children, because I think that being the oldest of five children has shaped a lot of how I see the world and how I work. And I also tell people that I grew up on a coast, because I also think that that changes the way that I see the world. The world seemed really, really big growing up, when you knew that when you drove down the road that Mexico was just on the other side of the water. And being the oldest kid in a big family, I grew up hearing over and over and over, you're responsible, you're responsible, you're responsible. And so I think that I bring a lot of that to work every day. And also just the idea that we're all connected and we're all responsible for one another. We're a community, we're a family. So I bring that to work. So yeah, that's a little bit just about who I am and how I grew up. Whenever I tell people about my professional trajectory, I always tell them that on my very first day of public school, I was the teacher. I was homeschooled my entire life, and through a bunch of different unique circumstances, which maybe we'll talk about a little bit later, I ended up becoming a public school teacher, and I was a public school teacher for 4 years. And then I tell people that I retired. And now I work at an education nonprofit where I coach teachers in their first and second year of teaching. I plan and execute professional development. And then I do a whole bunch of other stuff that there is not an easy bucket for.
Okay. Yeah. There's a lot to get to with your story. So I'm fascinated though, like, growing up, like you say, you were the teacher like the first day, right? But like you're responsible for all your siblings in a lot of ways, like feeling like you coached them along. I mean, was that the entirety of sort of your childhood all the way through?
Yeah, I think that one thing that's really interesting about growing up in a big family is my mom says that she doesn't think that any of us children ever grew up in the same family, because there's five of us, 8 years apart. And so your spot in the family, how old you are, the culture of the family at any point in time makes for really different and unique growing up experiences. Maybe in parts of my life, I felt like a coach for my siblings. I think that now I just feel like that they're my greatest gifts and my very best friends. So that's not something that I feel now. But also, like, an interesting thing is that of all of us children, we were all homeschooled kindergarten through eighth grade. A couple of us went to public school in high school, but now I work in public education. My sister's a counselor at a public school. My other sister is an elementary education major in college, and my sister-in-law is a public school teacher. So somehow our family of homeschool children ended up with a lot of people in public education.
That is fascinating. Yeah. That is fascinating. So let's talk about your road to public education then. How did all that transpire?
Yeah, so I changed my major a bunch of times. I went to school with this idea that school was more about what it did to me than what it did for me, which is still something that I deeply believe about education. I'm sure my parents just were kind of like, okay, we're going to be patient with the English major and then the Spanish major. They never once asked me what I was planning to do with it, which now as an adult, I'm like, man, that was an exercise in self-control, I'm sure.
Yeah, no kidding.
But I majored in a bunch of different things. I think that somewhere along the line, I'm definitely like a pretty high E on the Myers-Briggs. And I realized that if I majored in Spanish, I could go to classes where all I got to do was talk to people. It just had to be in another language. And that seemed like a pretty sweet deal to me. And so I ended up as a Spanish major, which I really, really enjoyed. And then somewhere along the line, I started Googling, what do you do with a Spanish major? This was somewhere like junior year of college, and not a lot came up. And so I was like, I should probably think about this, you know, which I guess is proof that typically if you don't pressure your children about things, they come around to it themselves. So I started Googling what to do. And a lot of the different things that came up were things about like teaching or translation. So I was like, I don't know right now that I want to live overseas. I should probably do something where I'm using Spanish in a professional capacity here in the United States. And so to make a really long story short, I ended up in Washington Heights, which is a primarily Dominican neighborhood in North Manhattan, where I was supposed to help with some parent translation at a summer program. So it's like a college summer internship. Most of the students there are first generation English speakers. And so I'm supposed to be helping translate for their parents over the course of the summer. So I get there and like day two, somebody's like, yeah, one of our teachers had to go back to the Dominican Republic to handle some family things. Do you want to teach first grade for the rest of the summer? And after day two in the office, I was already real bored. And I was like, sure, like I'll teach first grade for the rest of the summer. This sounds great. In hindsight, no idea what I was doing. My second day of work, I'm walking the 20 blocks back that I walked every day to the apartment futon that I was sleeping on. And I call my mom and I'm like, Mom, you have to tell me how to teach somebody how to read. I have 7 first graders and only 2 of them know how to read. You got to help me teach somebody how to read. And so I'm sure my mom's like, a 20-minute phone call is not how you learn how to teach early literacy. But she was patient. She told me all about consonants and blending and what I needed to show up and do the very next day. And so I'll never forget, there was a little boy in my class named Bryant, who was the cutest, sweetest little kid and came to us with just a criminal lack of phonics and ability to recognize letters from a school that he had been zoned for that was really underperforming. And so we worked all summer on blending. We worked all summer on learning how to read. And by the end of the summer, he could read and blend words all by himself. And one day he was doing it and he looked up at me and he was like, Miss Moss, I am a genius because I read this with my brain. And somewhere along the line that summer, I just realized that maybe I was going to be a teacher. And so I came back to Jackson, Mississippi, where I was going to college, and applied for this Teach for America program that I had heard a lot about. And so I ended up doing this alternate route program, and I liked teaching so much that I stayed for 2 more years after my 2-year commitment. And now I work at an education nonprofit, because somewhere along the line, my 4th year of teaching was the very, very hardest year that I ever taught. And there was this education consultant from Ohio who would come to my classrooms, and I called her my fairy godmother. She helped me so much whenever I was struggling. And I wanted to be able to do that for somebody else. And so now I work with 1st and 2nd year teachers, lots of whom are incredible, lots of whom are struggling. There's a lot of overlap between those things. I think they're all incredible and they're all struggling in lots of different ways. And so I love what I get to do.
That's really cool. I love that. So, I mean, I can't think of a more important thing to be doing for the education system than coaching 1st and 2nd year teachers. I have children who are in 1st and 3rd grade, and, like, you know, I pray for their teachers every day, right? It's like, it seems like such a difficult task, I guess, right? Like, you're taking all these wild children, you know, who are in different spots educationally and, you know, like you said, with phonetics and all that stuff, and sort of like bringing them together and coaching them. So do you mind talking just a little bit about what it is to, you know, coach those teachers?
Yeah, I really, really, really love the coaching part of my job. And I think that if you had asked me 2 years ago, whenever I first started, I would have told you that what I was really, really good at was logistics and execution and project planning and not coaching. But I think that that's definitely changed. And now coaching is both my favorite part of my job, and I don't know, it really gives me a lot of life to be able to work with people. And I think it's really just a huge honor to be able to coach people through their work, because that's a deeply personal and complicated thing. And so I think that two of the big things that I keep in mind whenever I'm coaching people is there's this, it's either a podcast or a TED talk where Brené Brown talks about this person that was really, 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 really getting on her nerves. And she's talking to her therapist about this person. And her therapist asked her the question, have you ever considered that maybe this person is trying the best that they can? And that floored me. And I asked myself, like, how would my life be different if I believed that every single person, from the teachers that I coach, to my coworkers, to my husband, to my friends and family, are trying the best they can with what they have? And so that really sent me on a journey for probably the past 2.5 years. I've been learning a lot about empathy and its role in the work that we do. And I really think that as a coach, one of the highest things that you can hold is a deep empathy for who somebody else is as a person. And I just finished this incredible book, Churchy by Sarah Condon, who does a lot of stuff for Mockingbird. And she says that empathy is whenever you can realize that you are beloved and that other people are beloved and there's no difference between you and them. And so that is something that I try to hold really, really close to my heart, and know that my highest performing teacher is trying the best that they can, and my most struggling teacher is trying the best that they can. And as a coach, Anne Lamott says that grace meets us where we are, but doesn't leave us where we found them. And I've kind of taken that on as my coaching manifesto. My job is to meet every single person that I work with where they are, but to not leave them where I found them.
Yeah. I just kind of want to, I think that's beautiful. I just kind of want to sit there. I feel like, you're so right. Like, if in every relationship, because it's grace, right? At the end of the day, it's grace, like giving people the benefit of the doubt, right? Like, if we could all just do that, the world would just be like magical, I think, right? I love that. I love that. How do you do that, though? I mean, how do you keep in that mindset, I guess?
Yeah. So I actually have, on my work computer, I have 2 sticky notes that are packing taped to either side of the trackpad, so that they're right in my line of vision a lot. And one of them is, I was on an Enneagram podcast that I first heard these like 4 rules for conversations. And they're 1, show up. 2, pay attention. 3, tell the truth. And 4, don't catch the results. And the podcast I was listening to said that they think that for every Enneagram type, one of those 4 things is incredibly difficult. And so knowing that for me, it's pretty easy for me to show up to conversations, but sometimes I have a lot harder time telling the truth if it's something critical and I have a really hard time not getting attached to the results has helped me to be able to monitor myself in conversations. And then the other sticky note just has a ton of questions on them. And I've really found that for me, asking questions is the best way to build empathy. And so typically if I feel that I'm kind of starting to let some judgment creep in or starting to let some, I don't know what else, superiority or just irritation, I try to ask a question instead of make a statement. And so I really think that the most magical question in the world is, can you tell me a little bit more about that? And typically I found that whenever I start to feel fussy or judgmental, if I just ask somebody to tell me a little bit more about it, usually they tell me more about it and it gives me way more appreciation, even if I don't always agree with it, for where they're coming from as a human being. And I'm able to think a little bit more expansively.
Yeah, that context is everything, right?
Yeah. And I think for me too, a lot of it has even been recognizing the mindsets that I have about myself. So I don't know that I am an Enneagram one, but I at least have a very strong one wing. And so I have really, really high standards for myself and get really frustrated whenever I don't meet them. And so thinking about how empathy has to start with me and extend to me, and I have to be gracious and generous with myself, just like other people, has helped me be able to be more generous with other people as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't, ones, right? It's the perfectionist tendencies, right? But those, so in order to sort of not put those tendencies on other people, because ones can come off in their, when they're unhealthy, they can come off as very judgy, right? Like of other people, because there's this like constant, like you have to be perfect, you have to be perfect. So that thing just extends to other people, right? So do you find that like when you give yourself empathy, that it's a lot easier to give other people empathy, like you have capacity for that?
Yeah, I think so. I think actually for me, interestingly enough, the journey has probably been in the reverse. I think that I read so many things that was like, you know, like if you can't show grace to yourself, you can't show grace to other people. But I actually think that when I started learning more about empathy and started being able to become more gracious towards people that I work with and for, then I was like, man, this feels really good. I wonder what it would feel like if I treated myself like this. Like, that might be nice. And so I think for me, the journey's been a little bit opposite, but still very connected.
That's interesting. I like that. Okay. So what is it like to coach a first and second year teacher? What is a process like? What do you do?
So I try to use a model that's called transformational coaching. It's by Elena Aguilar, who's written some incredible books. If anybody listening to this is involved in education, I use a lot of things from her book, The Art of Coaching, but she also wrote a book called Onward about emotional resilience that's really been fundamental. My therapist is probably tired of me quoting her book whenever I'm in counseling. I'm like, this education book that I'm reading says, she's like, I'm sure she's like, I went to school for this. Stop talking about the book you bought for $20 on Amazon. But I really do believe that coaching happens in conversation. And so I also think that coaching really, really differs person to person. And so I tell the teachers that I coach at the beginning of the year that my relationship with them and my support for them probably isn't going to look anything like my relationship with or support of anybody else in the group of teachers that I coach. And so I do a lot. The like model at its most basic is I come to your classroom, I watch you teach, we meet, we talk. So that's it, really, really basically how we talk or what part of your classroom that I come to or what we do in our meeting is going to vary greatly based on what your strengths are and what your needs are.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I guess that kind of like takes out my next question, which was like, what are some of the things that you see teachers struggling with in their first couple of years? Like common things, but I guess you see all sorts of stuff, right? Like each person is different in the things that they need and,
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there are some common trends. I think that one thing that I've learned from coaching teachers is that really the first and most important key to being able to work effectively and productively is being able to have strong mindsets and deep relationships with other people. I think that I've seen teachers who have strong positive mindsets about the students that they serve and deep relationships with their staff community, their classroom community, with parents. I've seen them struggle with things technically, but I've seen them rebound really quickly. Whereas teachers who excel in technical skills but don't have strong relationships or mindsets, I see take a lot longer to be able to really, really become successful and productive in the classroom.
Interesting. So I guess how then do you coach somebody through that? I feel like it just seems like you probably have a lot of awkward conversations. Is that true?
Yeah, it is. It is. I tell people sometimes that I have hard conversations for a living, but I really do think that that's a joy and an honor. And I think that I really do think that teaching is a difficult and honorable calling. I read an article a few years ago that talked about how if you teach in a school that serves low-income students, really the only career that's comparable with the kinds of demands that makes on your time is being an emergency room doctor. The way that you have to really, 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 really think quickly. They say that teachers make, I don't even know, like 30 decisions in a minute. It's constant. We are having to decide where I'm going to move my body. Am I going to move my body over by the friend who looks like he's about to fall out of his seat? Or am I going to move my body towards the side of the room where the student looks like they're really not sure how to do the subtraction problem? Everything from tiny decisions like that to obviously big decisions like planning your curriculum. And so I think that one of the things that I really, really enjoy is just being able to hold space for people to verbally process what they're going through in the classroom. Because I think that so often we see as teachers, at least when I was teaching, making sense of and reflecting on what we were experiencing in the classroom was something that felt like a unnecessary luxury, not something that felt essential, because it's like, I've got parents to call, I've got papers to grade, I've got to go by the Chevron that I know is the only thing open on the way to work to get Skittles to use for this pollen activity that we're doing. Was I trying too hard? Possibly. But all of those things build up, and then there's no time to just kind of sit back, zoom out, and ask myself, what do my relationships with my students look like? Am I meeting the goals that I set for myself? Is our classroom culture where I want it to be? And even, I think one of those powerful questions that I can ask teachers are two questions. Tell me something you're doing really well, and tell me about a student that you love. And those things tend to really, really reground people in their successes and in the things that are bringing them joy and light and laughter in the classroom, instead of focusing on the million things that always, always, always could be different and better.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. I mean, we all need space in our, you know, to process sort of what we're doing. And I feel like teachers are such a high pace, right? Like it's constant that, that space has to be pretty wonderful. So how do you fight burnout then? I mean, is do you feel like this processing like helps alleviate some of those, like, because I think, you know, first and second year teachers, I mean, there has to be a pretty high burnout rate, right? Like with some stuff like that. So how do you fight some of that burnout?
Yeah. I think that one of the key things to fighting burnout is remembering why you do what you do, not just what you do, or when you do what you do, but why you do what you do. And I think, too, it's interesting. I think that a lot of times I am working with teachers who are experiencing a lot of what I would call vicarious trauma. And so I work with teachers who work only in low-income schools. And so because of that, teachers are dealing with everything from underfunded classrooms to students who might have unstable housing situations, lots and lots and lots of things that come from systemic poverty and oppression. And so that's obviously a really, really, really heavy weight for a third grader to carry into the classroom every day. And when I'm the teacher of 27 third graders who are all carrying that weight into the classroom every day, that's really, really, really heavy on me. And so whenever I talk to teachers, I think that the emotional burnout is so much realer and more present than the physical burnout or the mental burnout.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I always think, like, with some of these kids and dealing with sort of the home lives and stuff, like their brains are so overactive, like trying to like process the trauma or process, you know, what's at home, or just like thinking about where your next meal is going to come from. Like you can't even get to the point where you can teach them, right? Because like their brain's processing so many things in the background that like even like quieting all those things to actually allow information in seems like one of the more difficult tasks of all that.
Yeah. And I think that like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right, tells us that we ultimately need to feel safe before we can feel self-actualized. Right. And so a lot of teaching for any teacher, it should be not just for teachers in low income or high need schools. For any teacher, part of the ultimate goal has got to be establishing a classroom where students feel safe. There's one teacher that I'm coaching right now who's one of her big goals is my classroom is a family. My classroom is a family. And I think about as a kid, how safe and ready to learn do I feel whenever I show up in a classroom and I know that when I get an answer right, everybody in my class is going to clap for me. They're going to give me a high five because we're a family. And if I can't get the answer right, somebody in my classroom is going to raise their hand and help me out because, again, we're a family.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's awesome. But I think at the same time, like having a classroom that feels like a family means that like you have to do some of the hard family stuff, right? Yes. I mean, like community is messy and mm-hmm. entering in, like truly entering in is mm-hmm. is difficult, right?
My favorite thing probably that I did in my fourth year of teaching, which was also my most difficult year of teaching, was we had a morning community meeting where a different student would run it every day and we would sit in a circle and we had like a whip around question and a talking stick and we like all did our class chant together. But then we would do a segment called Good News, Bad News. And if people had good news or bad news, they would raise their hand and say, if they said, I had good news, the whole class would say, yay. And if they said, I have bad news, the whole class would go, oh, man. And then they would say whatever their news was. And so some days our good news were things like, you know, my mom says that she bought them. Jumbo bag of Sour Patch Kids, and those are going to be in my house after school because, like, what are fourth graders into, right? Sour Patch Kids. But other days, yeah, I know, right? but other days, kids would share things like, I have bad news, and talk about hard things that they'd seen in their neighborhood, or talk about relatives that had passed away. And I was always incredibly impressed by their ability to support one another. If you haven't seen a tiny little 9-year-old boy shake his head solemnly and say, I'm sorry for your loss. I mean, I'm like, where is this maturity coming from? Like, you were just making bathroom noises in your armpit and I had to talk to you about this. And now you're talking like you're a 39-year-old man. So I'm continually amazed. I'm just continually amazed by the resilience and resourcefulness and light and life in the kids that I got to work with as a teacher. And now the kids that I get to see in classrooms all over the city that I live in.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. So what lessons from that fourth and hardest year of teaching do you feel like still really like propel you to do what you do? I mean, what was that year like, as much as you care to share about some of that?
Yeah. I think that I learned so many things that year. So I guess a little bit of context. I taught at an elementary school that was zoned for two really large public housing communities that our city was not taking care of, which was causing a lot of trouble and pain for the people that lived there. And I also worked at a school where, because of a bunch of different factors, we had something like 6 teachers quit in 8 weeks, which means there are substitutes, there are classrooms without teachers, there are split classrooms. And it was really difficult. As you can imagine, like, staff culture is not great whenever 6 people have all just quit in the middle of the year. But I learned a lot of different things. The principal who was there was a rock and an anchor for me in the middle of a really, really difficult year. And I'll never forget that the professional development day we had after the most recent teacher had quit, it would have been really, really easy to just like do a seminar on lesson planning, right? But every single teacher that worked there, she called into the library and she had us all sit in a huge circle facing one another. And she said, you all know that a lot of people who were here with us at the beginning of the year aren't here anymore. Every single one of you is still here, and I want us to go around the room and I want you to tell me why. And so seeing how somebody can lead whenever you are not in a great situation, trying to find some new people to hire in the middle of the year, is not any principal's dream scenario. But hearing why all of my colleagues were still showing up and doing their job every day, being able to share why I was doing that, because I believe that every single kid in our city deserves to learn from somebody who loves them, And then our principal says, like, we have some things that we can do to change and improve the culture of our staff, the culture of our school. What do you think those things are, and how can we do those together? And so I learned so much about leadership by watching her lead through that really hard and really difficult year. And I also think I just learned a lot about hope. I got to work really, really early and left work really late. And thankfully, like the way that my commute ran, a lot of times I got to see the sun rise on my way to school in the morning. I got to see the sun set on my way home in the afternoon. And that year I picked hope as my word of the year. And I decided every single time I saw the sun rise or I saw the sun set, I was going to see that as a reminder and a huge cosmic sign that there was so much to be hopeful for. And I think the like Bible truth that I really clung to during that year is, those who put their hope in me will not be put to shame. And realizing that a lot of times it felt really, really silly to hope that things could be dramatically different in a classroom where so many different factors, from systemic poverty to underfunding, were all really, really impacting us, but that I could still be radically hopeful, and that I had to believe that even if I didn't see immediate concrete change, that there was something that was inherently valuable about hope itself.
Jeez, preach. Oh my goodness.
That is, that's beautiful.
I mean, all we have, all we have at the end of the day is that hope, right? That's good stuff. So many thoughts there. So many thoughts. The leader, like, that's when you, I mean, true leadership is in those trenches, right? That's when, like, you separate the, like, leaders from the people just sort of posing, right? Like, do you really care about these people enough? I'm also getting, a second thought. This may not all make it on the podcast, but I'm definitely seeing your two come out right now. Like, I hadn't seen it yet, but you think you're a two with a one wing, right? Is that? Or vice versa. Or
I think I'm a two with a one wing. I think my one wing comes out real hard at work sometimes. My husband would probably say it comes out at home too. But yeah, I think I'm a two with a one wing.
My wife's a two. She's a social worker, but just a lot of the...
we're all hanging out there helping people somewhere. I listened to a podcast with Suzanne Stabile, like the Enneagram guru, and my husband's in my home.
Yeah.
But she was doing a Q&A session, and she was talking to a two who was asking, like, I feel incredibly burnt out. I feel like I'm geared for these, like, human being social services jobs, but I'm so burnt out. Should I just, like, go work in an office somewhere? And she said that she thinks that twos that burn out in helping professions are twos that haven't set strong boundaries. And so that's like the thing that I proclaim over myself every day is like, oh, you feel like you're burning out. You need to go back and look at your boundaries. But I think that one other thing on leadership, this picture that I have in my brain about what leadership looks like is, again, going back to the same principle. One day I walked into the cafeteria to do my breakfast duty, which is basically like opening milks for 5-year-olds and then like trying to help people not squeeze the jelly out of both ends of the jelly packet at the same time. And the breakfast line was super backed up. I guess somebody had called out in the cafeteria and our breakfast line's like running out the door of the cafeteria. And the principal walks in the cafeteria, sees what's happening, goes behind the breakfast line, puts on plastic gloves, and starts scooping scrambled eggs onto people's trays. And this is an incredibly accomplished woman who has a doctorate in education, who is a guru and expert on all things elementary curriculum. And she's like, that line's long. I'm putting eggs on people's trays. And so I think that's like a big question that I ask myself at work every day is like, what tray needs eggs on it? And how can I position myself to put them there? And so that means if I'm in a classroom with you and we're meeting on your planning period and you're stressed out because your floor is dirty, I'm going to talk to you while we both pick up pieces of paper off your floor, because I think that that's what leadership looks like. And it really helped me reframe a lot of things about how, like, the leader isn't the person with the office. The leader isn't the person who's got the title. The leader is the person who's able to, just like you said, be with people instead of across the table from people.
That's good. I'm going to have to remember that. How, what tray needs eggs on it? I mean, that's like such an easy mantra, right? Just take that with you wherever you go. There we go. I got my new thing. Good. Okay. So, I'm getting the feeling, and I may be opening a can of worms that I'm, that is going to take us a little bit too long, but I'm getting the feeling as we talk, you have some, thoughts on systemic poverty and racism. Is that true? Should we open that can of worms? Because I mean, my wife's a social worker. We, you know, she worked with women in their first 90 days out of prison. She's worked in the foster care system. I mean, we have, you know, worked in the projects, you know, all that stuff. So I have thoughts as well. And I would love to hear your thoughts if you're interested in going down that road.
Yeah, I think that, so going back to the thought from Sarah Condon that I talked about earlier about empathy, I think that whenever we think about systemic poverty and injustice, she said, you know, I'm beloved, other people are beloved, there is no difference between us. And I think that if we truly believe that in our country, that a lot of our systems would look a lot different. Yeah. And I'm not going to pretend like I'm an expert on anything, but I'm particularly going to try to stay in my education lane. Yeah. But the question that I ask myself and what propels me out of bed most mornings is, would I send my child to every single school in the district that I live in? And if I wouldn't, what do I need to get up and do about that every single morning? Because if a school isn't good enough for my kid or your kid, it's not good enough for anybody's kids. And it's part of our collective responsibility to make that better. And so really just this idea of there is no such thing as other people's children, which is Lisa Delfit wrote a book called Other People's Children that's really helpful. But yeah, this idea of there's no such thing as other people's children. And as a community, we have got to be able to guarantee that every kid in our community has access to a quality education has really become the heartbeat of my professional life. And why I do what I do every day is whenever I first started teaching, I was 22 years old. And I remember thinking, one thing I think about a lot anytime I'm like up somewhere high, like on top of a parking garage or like on top of a big building, is I think a lot about this idea of, I really do think that when the kingdom comes, it's going to be on earth as it is in heaven. And so I stopped thinking a long time ago about heaven as this like, you know, like otherworldly, like we're all wearing white robes. Like maybe we're wearing white robes. I don't know. My husband went to divinity school. We can ask him about that later. But I really think every single day, whenever I'm in our community or whenever I'm up on top of a parking garage and I look down, like, what would this look like if the kingdom had already come here? And one thing that I am sure about with every fiber of my being is it would look like schools where every single kid, no matter what their zip code is, no matter how much money they have at home, no matter what race they are, is able to get a quality education from someone who loves them. So as long as I'm able to keep doing what I'm doing, I'm going to keep working to make sure that whenever I'm not here anymore, Birmingham, Alabama looks a little bit more like that than it did whenever I got here.
I just want to like applaud or something. Like it's like such good stuff. Yes. So much. Yes. Yeah. And bonus points for weaving that question into sort of this whole idea of the podcast, which is a theology of hustle, right? Like the kingdom, what does the kingdom look like here on earth? That's like, that's it. Right. So good stuff. Okay. So in your mind then, and I know I want to stay in your education lane as far as this goes, but in your mind, is that simply a funding issue, like at its core, or are there other issues that you think aren't where they need to be? Is that too big of a question?
I mean, so I think whenever I think about like funding and economics, I think a lot about, I think it was Shane Claiborne who said that if we truly live in an economy of love, then capitalism won't be possible and socialism won't be necessary. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's usually never as simple as funding or economics. I think that ultimately it's really, I think it's a hard issue, right? Like I think that ultimately it comes down to, as somebody who has a lot of privilege, both like white privilege and economic privilege, what am I okay with people who don't share my same level of privilege experiencing? Mm-hmm. And what does that say about my heart? Yeah. And so I think it's circular, right? Like I think that part of the funding issues are tied to like deeper, more systemic heart issues. And then also I think that the heart issues like have begat some of the funding issues. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it's as simple as putting money places. I think I'm not going to turn down any money. Like anybody wants to give any money to the school system that I work with, like I'm here for it. I will never say that it will not help. But I don't think that only money is the answer. I have lots of thoughts that are too long for this, but lots of thoughts about integration. And I really, really recommend that anybody that's thinking through like what school equity could look like or why our country didn't really truly fully integrate after Brown versus Board of Education, or we did, but then within 10 years we resegregated. Listen to, there's a This American Life episode called The Problem We All Live With that talks about school integration in America that's really pushed my thinking on what equitable education could look like.
Interesting. Okay, I'll make sure and find that, track that down and put that all in the notes and stuff, because I'm probably going to be going back and listening to that. So that sounds awesome. I love that. It's good stuff. All right. So I know you've read Tib Keller's book, Every Good Endeavor. It's one that I recommend to everybody. But so how has this sort of worked itself out in how you go about doing what you do, the kingdom of God?
So I think that the biggest, I should say first, my husband has been incredibly helpful in helping me think about my work in new and different ways. He gave me Every Good Endeavor. I finally read it after like 2 years after he told me I should read it. So thanks for being patient, David. And he is kind of like one of those rare unicorn people that went to divinity school, but still is able to, I think, really truly and deeply connect with people who have callings outside of like formal church ministry and understand like how their work is meaningful and valuable. And I shouldn't say rare unicorn people. I'm sure lots of people can do that. I just happen to be married to this one. So,
well, you see it more than others, but I think there is something to that. I think pastors, people who have been through divinity school can get sort of lost in that. I see that in pastors around me sometimes.
Yeah.
That's fair.
And so I think that the probably most life-changing thing that I carry with me now every single day, that was an idea from the Tim Keller book, is that I was made to work, and that is a very good thing. And I think the thing that I would probably add to that then is, for a lot of my life, I think that I was always about like work-life balance and how can I work less? And I feel like I'm working too much. And you know, like, is work interfering with my ability to connect with people in our neighborhood or build strong relationships? And now I don't ask myself those questions anymore. I say, I was made to work. This is a good thing. The question that I need to ask myself is, what kind of place am I working out of? And am I working out of a place where I'm doing work with joy and a deep confidence that all that needs to be accomplished has ultimately already been done? Or am I doing work out of this place of like frantic striving and clawing and one more thing and trying to come out on top? And so I don't know. I love that. I love that I was made to work. Like, it's good. We have our organization has a large winter break every year. And every year I call it my annual winter break meltdown. It's usually after I've been off work for like 7 or 8 days. And I start spiraling out about like something like saving 10% on a shower curtain. And I'm like, this is why it was good that I was made to work, because it's way better whenever I put this energy into like working towards systemic equity than when I put this energy into like saving $2.95 on a shower curtain. So it's good that I was made to work.
I love it.
And I love that. I like that. I did not always like that, but now I would say that I really, really, truly like and take deep joy and honor in the fact that I was made to work and work really hard.
Yeah. I mean, so for you, what does it mean that you were made to work? I mean, how does that affect sort of the everyday thing? I mean, maybe I'm re-asking the same question. Is that no?
Okay. That makes sense. Like, I think that there is a mindset out there sometimes that like work is what you do from 9 to 5 so that you can make money to live your real life. Right. And I believe that work on some level is my real life. Mm. Now, it's not all of my life. Like, yeah. I have deep and loving relationships with my family, and my husband and I have a house that's like 100 years old and is basically a part-time job. So all of those things are like also parts of my life. But whenever I stopped seeing work as like this thing that I got to do so I can get to my life, and started seeing it as like actually maybe a place where so many of like the deep and good things about life can be experienced and worked out. It's made me way more content in the amount of time that I spend working.
Yeah. I mean, that if only everybody could sort of experience that. I feel like, the people that you receive customer service from at anywhere, right? Like if you really like truly saw your job as like what you were made to do and as your life, I feel like it changes everything, doesn't it? In a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I love that. That's good stuff. Okay. So one thing I wanted to make sure, do you feel like we've covered a lot of what you wanted to cover in all of this?
Well, I do think that I would be remiss if I didn't share my very, very favorite quote about work.
Let's do it.
Which it's from Teddy Roosevelt, but I'm going to be completely honest. I first heard it from Leslie Knope on Parks and Recreation. I don't like read, Teddy Roosevelt regularly, but I do watch me some Parks and Rec.
I'm with you there.
But he said that one of the greatest prizes that life has to offer is the chance to work hard at work worth doing. And I have that written on a sticky note that's followed me around to lots of different desks in two different states. And I really, really, truly believe that just like in one sentence, that's a lot of what I believe about work encapsulated, that it is a prize and a joy and an honor to get to work hard at work worth doing.
Yeah. Totally. I love that. If we could only all be Leslie Knope, right?
I feel like
that woman loves her some work, some city work. So that's good. I love that. One thing I definitely wanted to ask you about is I know you're a reader from following you on Instagram and all that stuff, right? I mean, you are an avid reader, you would say.
Oh, yeah. If I had any job other than the job I have now, 100%, I would be an elementary school librarian.
Really?
It is a missed calling in my life. Yeah.
Well, hey, there's plenty of time for that. So maybe you retire from coaching and that's your gig.
Yeah, maybe so.
There you go. So I don't even know what I want to ask per se. I just like book recommendations. All right. So I don't necessarily care about genre. Are you a big fiction reader then?
I read fiction, I read young adult, I read middle grade, I read nonfiction. I'm trying to dabble in poetry, graphic novels to broaden my horizons, but yeah, I read most things.
Okay. All right. Well, so then for this audience, right, we're probably, people in the working world, what are some books that people should be reading that you think are sort of like gems that people don't maybe know about or haven't read? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that one of the first things that I would say is I think whenever you read, it's good to think about why you're reading. And I think the answer to that question can be different for a lot of different people. I think that a lot of people read to get information, which is not a bad thing in and of itself. I think that that's a good thing. I've gotten lots of information from books that I've read. But I think a lot about a study that I can find and send you to link in the show notes, but people who read fiction are more empathetic. And I think that is fascinating. That's something that you do as a hobby can actually make you a more empathetic human being. And I know why that is, because I have only had one very particular set of life experiences. But whenever I read books about anything, whether it's people who are dealing with situations in their family that I haven't experienced in my family, or people who come from cultures that I don't have any experience with, and I get to get inside their head through a book, I really truly find that I have so much more empathy whenever I meet people who have different experiences that I have in life. Because even though obviously reading a novel doesn't make me like understand what it's like to be from XYZ country, but it gives me some insight into, not everyone is like me, and I can still connect with you and appreciate you and understand you as a human being that's made in the image of God. So huge plug on reading, not only to gain information, but also to be able to empathize with and connect to people and cultures and experiences that aren't yours.
Crap. That makes me really nervous, because I don't read any fiction. And so now I'm like, crap, I'm not empathetic. Oh, gee. So I'm now convicted. Okay. So now you've got to solve this problem for me.
Yeah. Okay. So, man, book recommendations. That's so broad. I'm going to recommend a couple books on education, because I think that that's one way, especially if you have never attended or had experience in going to a school where kids aren't getting access to an equitable education. And I think that books can be a way that you can really build that understanding and that empathy. And so one book that I'll recommend on education is called Hope in the Unseen, which I read this summer before I entered the classroom. And it's about a student who grew up in a low-income neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and then ends up at an Ivy League school, and really just like illustrates the fact that for so many students who grew up in poverty, getting to college is just the very first step, and that there's still so many different challenges and things to be overcome, but also so many dazzling assets that they bring to the table. So highly recommend Hope in the Unseen. It's like a narrative memoir. Other books about education that I would recommend. This isn't a series of books, but to every single person I know that is white, I am recommending Courtney Martin's series about education on Being. It's a set of articles, and I can send you the link, but she's talking a lot about whiteness and public education and choice and just how we process all of those things. It's been incredibly impactful for me as my husband and I think and talk about what we want our hypothetical future children's education to look like. So those are two resources that I'd recommend related to education. In terms of novels, I think relating to like poverty and systemic injustice, I would highly recommend two different novels. One's a grown-up novel, one's a young adult novel. The grown-up novel is called Homegoing, and it's two different women. The story is just kind of told through their family lineage, and it's really, really impactful whenever you think about how systemic oppression has impacted us in America going all the way back hundreds and hundreds of years. And then I loved, I'm sure everybody knows about this book by now, but I loved The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas, who's also a Jackson native.
Oh, really?
And it's, she went to college right down the road from mine. But there's also a movie now. I thought that the movie was incredible. So if you're like, I'm not a book person, you have no excuses. Go see the movie. They made one. It got a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes. I live and die by Rotten Tomatoes, much to my husband's dismay. I'm like 66%. I'm not going to see that.
No chance. I'm not wasting my time with that stuff.
So those are some books that I'd recommend. If you're just like looking for a real fun novel, the adult novel that got me back into reading was Where'd You Go, Bernadette. So I really, really like that one. And if you're looking for books that are related to Christian living or vocation or calling, I'd say obviously Every Good Endeavor is really good. Tim Keller's real smart, so it's like not a thing to read at the beach. Like, it's pretty academic. There were some times where I was like reading it on the treadmill and I was like, come on, like, oh, I need a brain break. But I couldn't recommend that book enough. And then two other great books that I've read this past year are Liturgy of the Ordinary by Tish Harrison Warren, and she just kind of talks through like the normal routines of life, everything from like setting an alarm to checking your email and how you can practice the presence of God in those things. So that was very helpful for me. And then I really, really loved Churchy by Sarah Condon, who she's a wife, a mom, and a priest, and she talks about God's love and God's grace, but also about vocation and things like that.
That was super impressive. That was off the cuff. I didn't prep you for any of that. You were not messing around. You had authors and titles and everything. Good work.
Good work. So books for days.
That's right. You need a shirt. Books for days. Is that a shirt?
Yeah, it should be. And hey, to plug a podcast guest that you recently had, instead of ordering all these books on Amazon, you should go to Annie B. Jones bookstore, the bookshelf online, and order them.
I've been linking to her now. So instead of Amazon, I link to her. So
I love it.
So anyway, I got to get down to the bookshelf at some point still. So
my mom and I went on Martin Luther King Jr. weekend last year. Nice. Like, we literally went there just to go to the bookshelf.
Really?
Drove like 5 hours each and met there. It was 100% worth a 5-hour drive.
That's awesome. Highly recommend.
Awesome.
There we go. I got my summer plans now. So.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you want to jump into our final two questions?
Yeah.
Okay. So first, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
So I thought a lot about this question, and I'm between two different things. I was an RA.
You can have two if you want. Okay. I mean,
one of them was a strange job. The other one, it was more strange how I got the job. So we'll go with both of those. But I was an RA in college, and I was an RA on a hall where half my student or a third of my students were from affluent suburban schools. A third of my students were from an urban school. And then a third of my students were international students who didn't speak English. So it was a party on third floor, Mary Nelson. But that was just really, really interesting. I think it was my first experience, like, leading a group of people who were very, very, very not homogenous, and not just leading them in like doing a group project, but actually like leading them in like living together and sharing a bathroom. So that was pretty unique. We dealt with everything together, including a huge incident that involved a stolen bathrobe that had flip-flops printed on it. Once I saw the bathrobe, I was like, who would want to steal this? Like, who would even want to own this? But, you know.
Yeah, both y'all are wrong.
Exactly. But then my very first job that I ever had, I was, or like job other than babysitting, you know, because oldest child in a homeschool family, did a lot of babysitting.
I'm sure.
But I worked at a coffee shop, and I went there and like applied and like, you know, like talked to the person or whatever. And they're like, we'll call you. And then they didn't call me. And then I called, and then they didn't call me back. And so then I just like showed up at this coffee shop and was like, listen, I really want this job. Like, I applied for this. You know, I know nothing about how jobs work. I'm just like, why haven't they called me? So I just like show up and talk to these people. And they're like, actually, like, we've just been so busy and so understaffed that we haven't even had time to call the people that filled out applications. Can you come tomorrow? And I was like, absolutely. I will be here tomorrow. And so I think that's just like the start of a long line of believing professionally that like, when in doubt, do not take no for an answer. And I would say overall, that's helped me out more times than it's hurt me.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, I totally agree. I think that's a good word to all those young people looking for jobs, yeah, right?
Don't take no for an answer.
It's good. That's right. That's right. It's exactly right. Okay. So finally, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring the kingdom of God into their work?
Yeah, I would say that it is important to remember that every good and perfect gift comes from above, and every single piece of truth is God's truth. And so I think that I have learned so much in my job from quote unquote secular leadership resources. I've learned so much from people who don't share my faith. And I think that it can be easy to come up with like a complex of like, I'm like listening to like Christian resources and only things that are like branded as Christian. And I think whenever we do that, we can miss out on so much richness and so much ability to grow in our roles and ability to grow in vocation. So I think it is like important to have something that you filter things through, right? And the standard for that is going to be the gospel. But I think that we get so caught up sometimes on like how things are branded that we don't think as expansively about truth as we could. And so, yeah, I would encourage people to go in with a bar for what you believe is true, but also to go in really, really, really open and with an open spirit and not a critical one.
That's awesome. I love that. That's such good stuff. Great job. Hey, it was so fun to chat with you.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on. It was good. It's good. So, all right. Well, thanks again. And hopefully we'll, you know, see each other around a little bit on Instagram or whatever.
Yeah. So. Or at the bookshelf, you know.
At the bookshelf. You're right. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Curry. Love you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Ruth Ann. I know I just got a lot out of her wisdom about coaching and about humility and all the things. And I have so much stuff to read now. It's kind of killing me, but I'm excited about it. So, hey, you know what? If you end up picking up something or reading something or listening to some of the stuff that Ruth Ann suggests, hit me up on Instagram. I'd love to hear about it. I'd love to hear what you thought. Yeah. We can keep the conversation going. And until next time, get out there and hustle.